Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the high drama on Capitol Hill, with a contentious hearing today involving top intelligence officials who appeared to be stonewalling, saying they could not talk about their conversations with the president without saying why and without denying that the conversations took place, all of which are documented in great detail on the front pages of today's Washington Post. Congressman Ted Lieu, who serves on the House Judiciary Committee and the House Foreign Affairs Committee, joins us to discuss the anticipation gripping Washington, D.C. ahead of tomorrow's testimony by the recently fired former head of the FBI, James Comey. We'll examine the disconnect between an open press and a closed government as the public waits for clarity on one of the most important issues of our time, and that is whether there was collusion between the Trump campaign and the Russians in the last election, which we know the Russians meddled in to help elect Trump. Then we will speak with a leading intelligence historian and expert on the NSA who attended today's hearings before the Senate Intelligence Committee. Matthew Aid, the author of Intel Wars, The Secret History of the Fight Against Terror and the Secret Sentry. He joins us to discuss the remarks by the former director of national intelligence that the Watergate scandal pales in comparison to the Trump-Russia situation we are confronting now, and whether witnesses who clammed up today will be more forthcoming in closed hearings. Then finally, we'll look into tomorrow's testimony by James Comey and discuss his opening statement that was released today by the Senate Intelligence Committee with Scott Horton, a professor at Columbia Law School and a contributing editor at Harper's in Legal Affairs and National Security. He joins us to assess the explosive nature of Comey's notes on meetings he'd had with Trump and some legal scholars already see as evidence of obstruction of justice, and discuss the fate of the young woman charged with espionage for what appears to be blowing the whistle on Russia's attempt to hack our election. And joining us now is Congressman Ted Lieu, who was elected in 2014 to California's 33rd Congressional District. He currently serves on the House Judiciary Committee and the House Foreign Affairs Committee, and he was also appointed as Assistant Whip for the Democratic Caucus. Welcome to Background Briefing, Congressman Ted Lieu.
Thank you, Ian.
Well, thanks for joining us, Congressman. And am I correct in suggesting that our nation's capital, Washington, D.C., is abuzz with anticipation for tomorrow's hearing, even though the opening remarks by James Comey have been made public?
Yes, I believe that tomorrow America is going to watch in real time as evidence of obstruction of justice unfolds. And FBI Director Comey, if he adheres to his opening statement, is going to describe the facts that establish Donald Trump's attempt to influence, impede, or obstruct an FBI investigation. That is a felony.
So you are talking about a criminal charge of obstruction of justice. I think it's, 1503? I can't remember the federal statute. But or are you talking about the different bar, which is an impeachment? In other words, there's a difference between a judicial trial and a political trial, which is what an impeachment is.
That's a great point. As a former prosecutor, I can tell you that what President Trump has done is not something that looks like obstruction of justice or could be obstruction of justice. It is obstruction of justice. There is no dispute that the president fired FBI Director Comey. And then the president went on national TV and said the Russia probe was on his mind when he did it. And then he told the Russians at a meeting at the White House that he did it to relieve the great pressure on him because of the investigation. White House does not deny those statements. If you just put that together, that is obstruction of justice. Now, the question of whether that is something that could lead to an impeachment, that is a different issue. Impeachment is also a political issue. And those are two different standards.
Well, what I was struck by, aside from the legality and the intense politics of the moment, Congressman Ted Lieu, is the way that James Comey vividly described these meetings in very succinct terms. He's obviously a very skillful note taker, but it feels like in many ways just two ships crossing in the night here, that there couldn't be any more different between this kind of buccaneer-style president who's clearly out of his depth and may possibly be out of his mind, and this career bureaucrat. Just quoting a piece which I found extraordinary. Near the end of our dinner, this is the January the 27th dinner that Comey reluctantly went to, and he was already put the squeeze on about whether or not he could keep his job, which could be construed as bribery, but we'll get into that in a minute. Just quoting Comey, near the end of our dinner, the president returned to the subject of my job, saying he was very glad I wanted to stay, adding that he had heard great things about me from Jim Mattis, Jeff Sessions, and many others. He then said, I need loyalty. I replied, you will always get honesty from me. He paused and then said, that's what I want, honest loyalty. I paused and then said, you will get that from me. As I wrote in the memo I created immediately after the dinner, it is possible we understood the phrase honest loyalty differently, but I decided it wouldn't be productive to push it further. The term honest loyalty had helped end a very awkward conversation, and my explanations had made clear what he should expect. Do you agree with me that this is amazing drama and almost sort of Shakespearean in the difference in these characters?
Yes. Let's just think about why Comey even took notes. It's because he was so freaked out by his conversations with the President of the United States, because they were beyond just not normal. They were bordering on criminality, and at least in one case, it was illegal what the president asked him to do, which is to drop the FBI investigation into Michael Flynn. But on the issue of loyalty, in our republic, there is only one loyalty oath, and that is the Constitution of the United States. I'm also a former active duty military officer. When I took that oath, it was not an oath to the president. It was not an oath to a political party. It was an oath to the Constitution. I'm glad that James Comey understood that. Unfortunately, our president does not seem to understand that.
And is there a case or any kind of incipient possibility of a case there in terms of bribery? Because it does seem like Comey made clear that in prior conversations, the president had made it clear that he was glad he was staying on. And then as he goes to this awkward dinner on January the 27th, which he didn't really want to go to, he's obviously very reluctant. And it's just the two of them sitting in the green room, I think, or I can't remember which room it was. But in any case, just the two of them, nobody else. And Trump starts out by suggesting that maybe his job is not exactly secure. So is that an opening gambit in terms of bribery? In other words, I'm telling you that I've got leverage over you before we even begin?
It would actually meet their statute for the obstruction of justice, because mm-hmm. he'd be using his position as president and has his employer to try to influence James Comey to drop the FBI investigation. It could also be viewed as abuse of power, which, by the way, has been used as an article of impeachment for prior presidents, and potentially bribery. I think that might be a little harder case to make, but you definitely have the first two, obstruction of justice and abuse of power.
So what do you expect tomorrow then, given that we've already gotten the kind of opening broadside here in the opening remarks, which, as you have made clear and other legal scholars have made clear already, that this sort of smacks of obstruction of justice?
I had the opportunity to question James Comey last year on the House Judiciary Committee. I met with him several times before, and while I did not agree with a number of his decisions, like many people, I absolutely respect his integrity. And I think tomorrow people are going to see that James Comey is an honorable, honest man. And they're going to contrast that with the president, who people know routinely makes misleading statements and just flat-out lies. And you're going to see an honest man tomorrow tell America the facts that then establish obstruction of justice.
And in terms of what the former director of National Intelligence, James Clapper, said on Wednesday in Australia before the National Press Club in Canberra, that he thought that the current situation, in terms of the Trump-Russia situation, that Watergate pales in comparison to what we're confronting now. Do you think that's a reasonable context to look at this whole situation in?
Absolutely. Let's think about Watergate. You had burglars who messed up in trying to take information from the Democratic Party. In this case, you actually have Russians come in, exfiltrate all this sensitive information from the Democrats, and then put it out there, and it hurt Hillary Clinton, it hurt congressional Democrats, as well as other candidates. They actually successfully weaponized information they stole. And if there's any collusion between Trump associates and the Russians, then that is a serious federal crime bordering on treason.
Well, just in closing, Congressman, in the hearing today before the Senate Intelligence Committee, Senator McCain was kind of bemused by the kind of, he said this is a kind of an Orwellian situation where the witnesses, these top intelligence officials, were stonewalling while right there on the front pages of today's Washington Post is in great detail. It is the very stuff that they're refusing to talk about, which is their conversations with the president, who wanted them to lean on Comey to stop the FBI investigation. So are we at a situation where we have an open press and a closed government? And it's clear to me that when you go into closed hearings, the public's never going to know unless it's leaked. And frankly, I think this is the most important political story for as long as I can remember, since perhaps going back to Watergate. I believe that the people in this country really want to know what the hell happened between Trump and the Russians.
I agree with you, and I think it is extremely telling that the head of National Security Agency, as well as the Director of National Intelligence, had multiple opportunities to simply say, no, the president did not tell us to get Comey to drop the investigation, as the Washington Post reported. They refused to say that. They simply said, we're not going to talk about it. And that tells me that, in fact, the Washington Post story is true because they do not deny it.
Well, Congressman Ted Lieu, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Congressman Ted Lieu, who was elected in 2014 to California's 33rd Congressional District. He currently serves on the House Judiciary Committee and the House Foreign Affairs Committee, and was also appointed as Assistant Whip for the Democratic Caucus. We're going to take a brief station break and be back speaking with a leading intelligence historian and expert on the NSA who attended today's hearing. You can't hide. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Matthew Ade, a leading intelligence historian and expert on the National Security Agency. He's a regular commentator on intelligence matters for the New York Times, the Financial Times, the National Journal, the Associated Press, CBS News, and many others. He is the author of Intel Wars, The Secret History of the Fight Against Terror, and The Secret Sentry, The Definitive History of the National Security Agency. And he has a forthcoming book also about the NSA. Welcome to Background Briefing, Matthew Ade.
Glad to be here.
And before the National Press Club in Canberra, Australia, the former Director of National Intelligence, James Clapper, said that when you compare the Russian investigation to the Watergate pales, in my view, compared to what we're confronting now. So that's a direct quote from the former DNI. And of course, we've had testimony today from the current DNI, Senator Coates, from the Deputy Attorney General, from the Acting Director of the FBI, and from the head of the NSA. So is that a context that's going to resonate, do you think?
Well, I think it's a premonition of things to come. The, you know, just a tad bit of context. Mr. Trump has only been the President of the United States for 6 months, and we already have a constitutional crisis on our hands here in the United States. And we have now charges of, basically unproven charges at this point, of obstruction of justice by the President of the United States. And this is a hell of a way to begin an administration. he hasn't passed any legislation yet, and he's already he's under investigation by at least five or six different bodies, depends on how you count it. I don't know how this is all going to end, but I don't think it's going to end well for the incumbent in the White House.
Well, we have an advanced copy, of course, of James Comey's opening remarks, which he will be delivering tomorrow before the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence. And quite a lot of that is pretty damning. And I'd like to run some of that by you. But let's just touch on today's hearings before the same Senate Intelligence Committee with, again, the head of the NSA, the DNI, the acting FBI director, and the deputy attorney general. Clearly, the Democrats were frustrated by the answers. And what I thought was interesting about the answers to the basic question about whether Trump tried to lean on them to either slow walk or kill the investigation, all of them basically said, well, we can't talk about the president's private conversations with us. We can do that perhaps in closed session. But they didn't deny the very possibility itself, did they, at least to my knowledge?
No, it was all four men basically issued rather strange non-denial denials, as we say here in Washington. You know, I was at the hearings, and I have to tell you, Republicans were just as frustrated as the Democrats because, you know, I think the main issue from today's hearings is the fact that both Republicans and Democrats pressed the four intelligence officials in the dock about whether they were exerting executive privilege, meaning, you know, they were refusing to talk about their confidential conversations with the President of the United States. And they all said, no, we're not. And which led to more questions about, so under what authority are you declining to talk about this? I mean, even, a yes or no answer. Did the President of the United States ask you to attempt to influence the former director of the FBI, Jim Comey? And they refused to talk, give a yes or no answer to that. And so you can understand the frustration. And, there were bouts of anger thrown back and forth, but this is becoming very typical in Washington these days. So we ended up with a hearing where nothing was learned, essentially, other than the fact that four senior leaders of the U.S. intelligence community just basically don't want to talk about their conversations with the President of the United States.
In public. They did agree to speak about it in private, I think.
Yeah, but, even if they talk about it in executive session, the first thing that is going to happen is both Democrats and Republicans are going to run out of the hearing room and tell the public what it is that they said. And these four leaders of the U.S. intelligence community knew days in advance that they were going to be asked these questions or variations on this theme, and they knew that nobody was going to be satisfied with their answers. I think, in retrospect, I would have taken a different tack. Talking about it, you know, saying I'll talk about it in behind closed doors is not the answer in this particular instance.
Well, it certainly felt like they had coordinated because they were all on the same page.
And they were reading off the same talking points.
Exactly. And again, I'm speaking with Matthew Aid, who's a leading intelligence historian and expert on the National Security Agency. He is the author of Intel Wars, The Secret History of the Fight Against Terror, and The Secret Sentry, The Definitive History of the National Security Agency. And he also has a forthcoming book about the NSA. So the one senator, though, on the Republican side who I thought did a pretty good job in a kind of bemused and ironic way was Senator McCain, where he kept saying, look, here, and he's holding up the Washington Post, here it all is in the today's edition, times, dates, incredible details about how you were all leaned on by the president to try and muzzle Comey, and yet you can't talk about it. I mean, what's going on here? He actually used the word, there's an Orwellian quality to this.
Well, I talked to one of the administrative assistants to one of the senators who's a member of the Intelligence Committee, and he sort of looked at me and he said, is there anything that these four men know that isn't on the front page of the New York Times or the Washington Post? So, it's a very ironic situation.
So, is it possible that any of them leaked this stuff, or people that they know leaked it?
When you read these stories, it's a game here in Washington. The first thing that people like myself and others do is we sit there and look at the story and try to deduce or discern who the potential sources are. And it's usually if the reporter is good, you can't tell. And so far that's the case. But, I don't think there's a single deep throat here who is feeding all this information to the New York Times and the Washington Post.
Well, they are devoting a lot of resources, and every day there's a breaking story, and sometimes several breaking stories per day. And
it's highly very confusing for people like me.
Right. Well, but it's also highly coincidental, is it not, that this is on the front page of Washington's newspaper, the Washington Post, on the very day that these guys are being questioned about the contents of this lead story and are unable to go public or tell the public what they know without claiming executive privilege. So it was a very strange and obviously frustrating experience for the senators. What do you make, then, of the tomorrow's testimony, an advanced copy of which the statement in the opening statement has been made available, James Comey going through his meetings with Donald Trump, the January 6th briefing, then the January 27th dinner, and then the February 14th Oval Office meeting, and then finally the March 30th phone call, all of which are very, very detailed. I mean, he obviously has a steel trap of a mind in terms of being able to recall all the details, including the grandfather clock ticking in the background, etc. So
I think he took very good notes. I think knowing Mr. Comey, I'm sure he was taking notes during each and every phone call. And as soon as each meeting was over, the first thing he did is he ran back to the office and dictated a memo for the record or for the files. You have to understand, Mr. Comey, I know of Mr. Comey from his days during the warrantless eavesdropping crisis during the Bush administration, where he stood up to the president of the United States at the time, George W. Bush, and it was entirely his notes on these meetings, including the famous meeting at the bedside of Walter Reed Medical Center, where he and the then Attorney General refused to reauthorize the what we now know to be an illegal warrantless eavesdropping program. I mean, this is the way he operates. He's a copious note taker. He believes in papering the file. He's a very old-fashioned, I guess you could call him a bureaucrat, in the sense that, you know, 50 years ago, everybody kept diaries and, kept notes for the record of every conversation they had. That system died, or has been dying slowly for a long time, but he still maintains the tradition. And I think that is the danger for Mr. Trump. I think Mr. Comey has somewhere in his files a lot of paper that could be very damaging to the President of the United States. And I think we're seeing some of it in the in the prepared testimony, which is now available to the public on the Senate Intelligence Committee's website.
But it does seem, though, that there is something different about the Comey situation. I don't know whether he has always covered himself in with such accurate or apparently accurate notes with other political leaders. It seems that there's something about Donald Trump. And clearly, in the written testimony that he's delivering tomorrow, he does talk about how awkward these meetings were. But we have to surely put this in the context now that he was, one, he was fired. Two, Trump told the Russians in an Oval Office meeting that the guy's a nut job. And yes. And then three, Trump called him a grandstander and a showboater.
Yep.
So I think Comey will be subtle in sticking the knife in, won't he? He won't appear to be operating out of payback. But my feeling is he'll do everything he can to lay this case on the line in as damaging a way as he feels. Well, I don't know whether he feels.
Well, you have to remember, he's a very good lawyer. He's a government-trained lawyer, and he's thinking like a prosecutor, and he will. You know, his prepared testimony reads like a criminal indictment, but without the, you know, we hereby charge you with, a portion of the document. But, you know, he is laying out a predicate. He's making a case for the fact that I'm right and the President of the United States is wrong on the facts and on the truth. And, you know, and also you have to remember, you know, he's built a career on moral rectitude, on being right, whether you agree with him or not. I mean, the fact is that, you know, he honestly believes that, you know, the truth is important. And so I think that, you know, we're going to see some of that tomorrow. We're going to see, he will be calm, deliberate, he will be factual, you know, like a good prosecutor would be. But at the same time, remember that Donald Trump is going to be counterpunching on Twitter, you know, and so you may get this rather bizarre situation where Comey is delivering his testimony and answering questions from the members of the committee, while at the same time behind them, their aides are staring at their iPods or iPhones and watching how the President of the United States is responding, you know, minute by minute to what Mr. Comey is saying. And so we may get a rather strange form of intercourse where the senators will have the president's, responses, and they'll ask Mr. Comey for his take on what the president is saying. It could be, you know, this is the new intrusion of a technology into the process.
Well, there were, in spite of the fact that, as you point out, Matthew A., that wasn't just the Democratic senators that were frustrated by the testimony of the NSA head, the acting director of the FBI, the deputy attorney general, and the director of national intelligence, all of whom seemed to be singing from the same hymnal. On the one hand, not saying that it didn't happen, but on the other hand, saying they can't talk about it.
Right.
And not saying why they can't talk about it. So it was pretty surreal.
Not in public.
Right. So, and then, of course, in private, that's useless. As you pointed out, it's likely that it'll be leaked profusely. But there were still those ridiculous questions about unmasking, which is this pathetic attempt on the part of the Republicans to try and distract the issue away from the Russians to some alleged impropriety on the part of people like Susan Rice in the Obama administration. So do you think that tomorrow's testimony, the Republicans are going to go resort to that, to basically not ask Comey relevant questions, but just to slow things down and distract? Or do you think it's just they're going to be looking pretty stupid if they do that?
I know that Senator McCain, for example, who he and the senator from South Carolina, Lindsey Graham, who is his close friend and confidant, have, you know, I know Senator McCain is going to ask questions on target about the subject at hand. What Senator McCain's fellow GOP members may do, one can only guess, but you can't ignore the fact that Jim Comey is sitting, you know, at the witness table for one reason and one reason only, which is to talk about you know, the allegations of collusion between the Trump campaign and the Kremlin. And, you know, you can try to divert attention, but nobody, at least in the American press corps, is going to be writing about unmasking tomorrow. It's all going to be about Mr. Comey's testimony about the alleged collusion aspects of this case. So, you know, I don't, if the Republicans want to, you know, waste their time and their efforts, you know, they can go that the unmasking route. But I think their time and efforts would be better spent by sticking to the issue at hand, the one that the American public is interested in and the one that is driving down President Trump's approval ratings, which is this whole issue of the Kremlin.
So do you think there's a possibility that there'll be a migration of these defenders of Trump in the Republican Party? Let's just start with the senators on the Intel Committee. As you mentioned, it does seem that McCain is asking relevant questions, and today he was more or less implying that you guys are a bit of a joke here. You know, here you are not saying a damn thing, and it's all on the front page of the Washington Post, and it's here in detail in the Washington Post, you know, so who needs the intelligence community if you could read it all in the...
Why are you here if you're not going to talk about this?
Right. Who needs the intelligence community if you can read all about it in today's paper? That was more or less the way he was... So do you think there's anybody else? I mean, people like Cotton seem to be so damn partisan, it's ridiculous.
Yeah.
But I guess this...
You may remember the movie Dr. Strangelove. Mm-hmm. There's a famous scene in the movie where the Russian ambassador tells the president of the United States, "We know that you have been building your own doomsday device," and the president says, "I don't think I'm not aware that we have." And he turns to the Russian ambassador turns to the president and with great gravitas says, "We read it on the front page of the New York Times." So, yeah, that's, you know, we now have, if you want to find out what's actually happening in this case, most of which is happening behind closed doors. This is the first time we've actually had the opportunity for the public to watch the investigative process unfold. But then they're going to go back behind closed doors, and then tomorrow there will be more articles in the New York Times and the Washington Post about, you know, what's going on, in the investigation. So, you know, it's slightly surreal, but this is the way Washington works these days.
Well, just in closing, though, do you think that since Trump has created this alternative universe by suggesting that the failing New York Times, as he calls it, prints fake news and what he says is the truth, when most people think that Trump is a serial liar and that what's coming out in investigations by the Washington Post and the New York Times are the truth? So can he still play to his constituency and somehow dismiss all this as fake news? Even though Comey, I think, is a figure that's considered, even by conservatives, to be pretty credible?
Well, first of all, you have to remember Jim Comey is a Republican. He is conservative politically. But what he has going for him is he has a reputation for honesty and moral rectitude. I mean, you know, you talk to anyone who's ever met him, you know, counts him as a friend, and that's what he has going for him. We have a president, on the other hand, who doesn't, who has sort of a casual relationship with the truth, and you know, it's a personal opinion. But it's supported by, you know, the majority of Americans today, which is a very sad state of affairs. And, you know, we have now, we're going to have tomorrow the equivalent of a 12-round bout with Mike Tyson. You know, it's going to be a slugfest. And at the end of the day, Trump's 34% of the American populace will stick with him thick and thin, and the remainder of America will probably come down on the side of Jim Comey. I'm just guessing, unless Jim Comey makes a horrendous error and makes a massive mea culpa, that's probably what is going to happen tomorrow. Then the question becomes, what next? So Comey gets his day in court, he says his piece, and then what happens? And that's the $64,000 question that we don't know the answer to. The Mueller investigation, this is the former director of the FBI, and his investigation is just getting started. It's going to take a long time, and so that's where... You know, Comey has, I am sure Comey will provide his notes and other documents to the Mueller investigation. That's when things will start getting interesting.
And those two are friends, so...
they are.
So, more trouble for Trump. I thank you for joining us, Matthew Aid.
My pleasure. Thank you very much for having me on.
A pleasure. And again, I've been speaking with Matthew Aid, who's a leading intelligence historian and expert on the National Security Agency. He is the author of Intel Wars, The Secret History of the Fight Against Terror, and The Secret Sentry, The Definitive History of the National Security Agency. And he has a forthcoming book also about the NSA. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back looking into tomorrow's testimony by James Comey, and we'll be discussing his opening statement that was released today by the Senate Intelligence Committee.
I'm sick and tired of hearing things from uptight, short-sighted, narrow-minded hypocrites. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politicians. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Scott Horton, who's a professor at Columbia Law School and a contributing editor at Harper's in Legal Affairs and National Security. He served as counsel to Andrei Sakharov and Elena Bonner, among other activists in the former Soviet Union, and serves on the American branch of the International Law Association and has represented a variety of journalists and whistleblowers. Welcome to Background Briefing, Scott Horton.
Great to be with you, Ian.
Well, thank you, Scott. And today, of course, we had testimony before the Senate Intelligence Committee from the director, the head of the NSA, the director of National Intelligence, the deputy attorney general, and the acting FBI director. All of whom seemed to be on the same page in this surreal non-denial. They didn't exactly deny that Trump had tried to lean on them to lean on Comey, the FBI director. but they said they couldn't talk about it, but then they wouldn't say why they couldn't talk about it. So, and it was needless to say, the Democrats were frustrated, and so were some of the Republican senators. So just to touch on it, what did you make of it?
Well, I your characterization is just correct. I think it's remarkable, particularly Rogers and Coates came out with very tightly coordinated, very carefully scripted statements, and they held to those statements all the way through. And those statements were a cleverly worded dodge. So, I mean, I think the main point to make is, you know, had the answer to the question, did Trump lean on you to try to shut down the investigation or to mislead the public about it, the answer no would be simple and wouldn't raise any problems. So, of course, they could have said that. So the fact that the answer was not no means that the answer was some permutation of yes, but they weren't going to get into exactly what permutation of yes it was. So I think that's sort of a short take on it. And as to the why, I mean, you know, to me, remarkable that they wouldn't explain why they wouldn't answer the question. And I think Angus King did a very good job of pressing them on this, saying, you know, if this is an invocation of executive privilege, you need to say that. That needs to be put on the record that executive privilege is being invoked. And I think that's really the only plausible explanation for the non-response here, that is executive privilege. And there, of course, you've got, you know, you have a real problem as to whether executive privilege hasn't been waived by statements that have already been made by the president and others on his behalf.
So let's turn then to tomorrow's testimony, and we have the statement for the record to the Senate Select Intelligence Committee by James Comey has been released. So these are his opening remarks, and he refers to the January 6th briefing with the president, the January 27th dinner that he had with the president, incredibly awkward from what you read. And he, by the way, he writes very clearly about what's happening and quite descriptively. And then the February 14th Oval Office meeting and then the March 30th phone call. So, and the final April 11th phone call as well. So those are the, they're all very highly detailed. And I guess the most damning stuff, from since you're a law professor, Scott, is asking Comey to lay off General Flynn, what, just a day after Flynn was fired?
I think that's right. I mean, I think these, you know, it's 7 pages long. It's very, very dense and very careful. And I think, you know, we say in a legal setting that detail, precision, and absence of efforts to shade things one way or the other with too many adjectives and adverbs, that's the hallmark of a good statement and a reliable statement. And this, the way it was prepared, you know, it really was prepared as a statement that would be used in a court of law for fact finding. I think it was very, very, very carefully crafted, very well crafted, avoiding argument or characterization. So it really was just the facts. And I think the facts that are presented are, you know, a huge problem for Donald Trump, just no doubt about that. And I'd say that at 2 levels. So most of the discussion that's going on has focused on obstruction of justice. Obstruction of justice is something that, you know, under American law is actually almost remarkably easy to charge, but actually isn't charged very often. So even though the threshold for it is fairly low, the prosecutors tend to be extremely restrained in when they bring such cases. I was involved in one just a couple of years ago in which a party discussed and planned the destruction of documents that were sought under a subpoena and took acts to do it. That was enough to get things charged. But it really does take, take quite a bit before they actually bring the charges. Now, I would say Jeffrey Toobin has already already been on the air saying this is enough for obstruction charges. And I'd say that's right. You know, that's right because the threshold isn't a terribly high threshold. But, you know, this is not the sort of thing that would result in charges in a federal court. We need to be very clear about this. The standard you're talking about here is a standard of political crimes in the Constitution. And that means that the House of Representatives would have to decide whether they think that this is serious enough to warrant some sort of action in a bill of impeachment. But there's a second thing here, too, beyond the obstruction of justice matter, and that's bribery. And there, there's some really disturbing passages in this statement that bring the bribery issue into question. So you know repeatedly when Trump is setting up these discussions with him, he is dangling Comey's position as director of the FBI in front of him, suggesting that his answers will determine whether he is going to be reappointed or not. Now, you know, under federal statutes, FBI directors are appointed for a term of 10 years. So they're not like other federal officials who have to submit their resignations at the end of every presidency and hold them out. So that was a rather odd thing for Trump to have done. It was not in his remit to reappoint him. He would have to actually fire him in order to make a new appointment. So, of course, that was the implication from the outset with all these things. And he was tying this decision about whether he was going to reappoint him or not to questions of his fidelity, and specifically then to whether he pursued the Russia investigation, pursued the matter against General Flynn, or whether he was not in fact going to be instructed to find that there was nothing there in the Christopher Steele dossier. That's really quite exceptional. And all that could easily be interpreted as bribery. That is, offering the implicit appointment, a reappointment of Comey as a director of the FBI in exchange for his performing as Trump is instructed. And that is one of the specifically recognized political crimes in the impeachment clauses of the Constitution.
Well, you're referring then, of course, to the very awkward January the 27th dinner that Comey writes about, where Trump had already sort of congratulated him, saying he's staying on, and then suddenly he starts out the dinner by suggesting that maybe his job is up for grabs. Then the president says, "I need loyalty, I expect loyalty," and if Comey just doesn't know what to say, he's just kind of speechless. And then near the end of the dinner, again, the president returns to the subject of Comey's job, which you're suggesting has a, sort of the whiff of bribery. And then again, Trump says, "I need loyalty." And Comey replies, "You will always get honesty from me." And then Trump says, "That's what I want, honest loyalty." And then Comey pauses and then says, "You will get that from me." I don't know what the term honest loyalty we don't even know what that means. So it's pretty obvious what's going on here, isn't it? That this is, you know, if not criminal, it's certainly improper.
Yeah, it's improper. And here, the crimes we're talking about, I think we need to step back and note, we're not talking about the kinds of crimes that get charged in a federal court as federal crimes. You know, we're talking about a sort of rarefied group of what are known as political crimes, and that is incorporated into the Constitution through the impeachment process. And the Constitution recognizes that, you know, it's not that the House of Representatives issues a bill of impeachment that's a charging document like a federal prosecutor's indictment. It's something different from that. It's they make a judgment that the action that is described constitutes a political crime of some sort, and that it's sufficiently weighty and grave that it should go for trial in the Senate, right? So, and I think this kind of bribery, that is, tying the performance of a law enforcement official to his appointment, this is something that clearly would be within this remit of bribery as understood under the Constitution. And obstruction, of course, is something that was charged previously in Watergate, figured earlier in the Teapot Dome scandal as well. So that's pretty well established as something that's covered in the American impeachment process.
Well, I think the Scott Horton, the person who comes across poorly in this, is Sessions. And I don't know whether I'm reading too much into it, but I get the impression that Comey and the DOJ people, and particularly the FBI people, don't have much respect for him. And Comey asked him to, just don't put me in this situation again, after he'd been corralled by Trump, and Trump had kicked everybody out, including the vice president and Jared and Sessions. And after this awkward meeting, he says, I implored the Attorney General to prevent any further direct communication between the president and me, and Sessions did not reply.
And this is a well-understood function of the Attorney General's office. I mean, the Attorney General is supposed to stand as an interface between the White House and the professional prosecutors and professional investigators, and is supposed to act to limit interference or manipulation. So the fact that Sessions failed to perform that politically essential function is really, it's a disturbing fact. But I think you're right when you say this man, Sessions does not have stature and is not a highly respected figure. And indeed, it's clear that several years back he was bucking to become the chairman of the Judiciary Committee, or at one point also the Republican ranking member on the committee, and his fellow Republicans thought it was just too important a position to entrust to him. So even his peers and the Republican Party have always been nervous about him as a figure. They've clearly thought he lacks the correct judgment to hold such an important function. And that was, within a Senate committee. And that now he is the Attorney General. And we see in his actions over and over again just very, very poor judgment being exercised. In this case, really terrible judgment. He will wind up, being an important witness who's going to be interviewed by Bob Mueller and the investigation. And from everything we've seen, and we don't know the entire story, but from everything we've seen, he is an astonishingly weak attorney general who fails to stand up to the president and the White House in the way he's expected to do. And, I think, there have even been public sessions where, Michael Mukasey, the last Bush attorney general, was asked about some of these things. In fact, asked specifically about the sort of juxtaposition of reappointment of the FBI director with his performance. And Mukasey said, that was, from his perspective, simply unthinkable that the president would do such a thing.
So since, Scott Horton, since you have represented a variety of journalists and whistleblowers, what do you make of this 25-year-old NSA contractor who's just been arrested? She had sent some information to The Intercept, and since they published it, the NSA or the investigators were able to track it back to her because she had apparently communicated with The Intercept prior to that. She certainly doesn't seem like somebody that's trying to be secretive and covert or in any way steal secrets, but rather to get this information out to the public. And frankly, what the information is pretty damning. I mean, it's some of the most damning information we've had so far about Russian involvement, that literally right up before the elections, they were hacking into various election facilities and election officials with spear phishing, etc. And they didn't pull the trigger on disrupting the election, but it looks like they laid the groundwork. Then this again is the fancy bear front for the GRU, the Russian military intelligence. So I find it a little ironic that that's the content. It seems to have been lost, the importance of the content, in terms of buttressing the general idea that people, for some reason or other, some people on the left are still denying Russian involvement. This is probably one of the most flagrant smoking guns of Russian involvement. And, of course, some people at The Intercept have been on that side, along with, of course, the editors of The Nation magazine in denying a Russian involvement. I find that a little ironic.
Right. I think we have to look at this at two different levels. So the first is, you know, the document that she leaked, is that something that arguably should have been made available to the American public, where the decision to retain it and keep it secret was a mistake? And on that point, you know, from everything I've seen in it, usually we have arguments that disclosure would compromise a source or means of intelligence gathering, and that justifies keeping it secret. There's one passage that's marked out that was not disclosed where that may be an issue, but, you know, from the other passages of it that I've read, it seems that there's remarkably little basis to make an argument of that sort. And on the other hand, the memo does show fairly that the penetration by Russian intelligence into the voting apparatus was far more serious than the public was led to believe. In fact, the public was told, while there were some attempts to get into voter rolls, that this doesn't seem to have gone anywhere. And we see from this memo that, no, it was far more serious than that. There was an attempt to get into the software of the voter tabulation systems, which is, you know, far more serious and threatening thing. So I think there's a very, very strong public interest in having the information presented in this info and understanding more deeply the nature of the threat that was presented. So on that hand, there would be a very, very strong case that this person really is a whistleblower. And then I think when we look at her, there's no reason at all to suspect espionage is at play here. And this person is an Air Force, a uniformed Air Force officer, and has served loyally. Definitely has some civil liberty views, but was not collecting information and passing it to a foreign power. You know, her objective was to make it public, and she in no way, as you pointed out, in no way did she try to do this furtively or covertly. She did it so openly that the government had no problem tracking her down and identifying her. And she immediately acknowledged to them when interviewed that she did it all. So, you know, there's no question that she's the person and she did it. That weighs in favor of her remarkably, I think, on honesty. So this would be a case where, you know, if you look at the punishments that are meted out, taking away her security clearance and her pension and things like that would be reasonable things to do, but putting her in prison for many years would be a very unreasonable thing to do. And yet that's what the Sessions Justice Department is definitely going to attempt to do. We'll see how it unfolds.
Well, Scott Horton, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Great pleasure.
Thank you. Again, I've been speaking with Scott Horton, who's a professor at Columbia Law School and a contributing editor at Harper's in Legal Affairs and National Security. He served as counsel to Andrei Sakharov and Elena Bonner, among other activists in the former Soviet Union, and serves on the American branch of the International Law Association and has represented a variety of journalists and whistleblowers. And again, I'm Ian Masters, and this has been Background Briefing. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.